I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined today by none other than the world champion, multi-world champion, multi-Olympic champion, Sir Chris Hoy. Sir Chris, very warm welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I apologise for the sort of dressed-down appearance. I thought it was an audio podcast. I didn't realise. Everybody at home.
I've got a much worse body, so that's why I'm hiding it under a jacket. Now, before we go anywhere, I must tell you all about two amazing readers' events that we've got coming up at Motorsport Magazine. The first is on September the 10th, and that's with Nigel Mansell. And then on September the 20th, we've got one with Gordon Murray. Two icons of the sport, an overused word, but not in this case. So if you'd like to learn a little bit more about them, book tickets, which are selling very, very fast at the moment, then please go to motorsportmagazine.com/events. Now, Chris, we are in one of your locals up in Cheshire, and not only have we spotted the Cheshire housewives here for a meeting, we've also got someone trying to drill through the wall next to us.
Yes.
So if there's any interruptions...
What do you think would be more irritating out of the two? Well, you had to say.
Having only heard the drilling and not the housewife, I'm going to go drilling for now.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see. So now, obviously, we've got lots to cover. We've got some readers' questions. Want to talk about cycling and also, obviously, motorsport, of which you're basically kind of busy every single weekend, you were just saying. I think to start with, I read somewhere that you were inspired by E.T.
Yes. Yes, I was.
To go cycling?
I was, I guess I was about 6 years of age, and it was just before BMX was kind of hitting, you know, the shores in the UK. It was a phenomenon in the US at that point. And I watched the film E.T., and it wasn't the scene where, you know, they're flying off into the sky. It was the chase scene at the end where the kids are on BMX bikes, they're going over jumps, they're going around corners in a way that I'd never seen a bike used before. And I was just I thought this is amazing. I'd love to give it a go. So immediately asked my parents for a BMX bike. I think they thought it was going to be a passing fad. So, you know, they said, well, we'll get you a bike. It'll be a BMX. And it clearly wasn't. They got it from a jumble sale for £5. My dad resprayed it black and he put BMX stickers, BMX handlebars on it. And to me, it was a BMX. And that was what got me started.
And but you would, I suppose what some of the sort of motorsport listeners won't know about is that obviously you went into track cycling, but not until you had done quite a few years of BMX racing.
Yes, that's right. I raced BMX from the age of 7 till I was 14, and then I tried mountain biking, road racing, time trialing. Yeah, I was pretty much rubbish at all of those things. And then found the track, and I wasn't that great initially, but I loved it. It was the speed. It was the the intensity of the competition. There was a track in Edinburgh near where I lived, so I had the access to this facility. At the time, there were only two sort of international standard tracks in the UK, so I happened to live, you know, 2 or 3 miles from one of those, which was just amazing luck, because if the facility hadn't been there, I wouldn't have had the chance.
And with the BMX racing, do you think, sort of looking back on that now, that gave you a founding, kind of once you got into your track cycling, you changed from, you know, the kilometre sprint through to the Kieran, there's all the tactics. Did that have an influence, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the best thing about BMX was that no matter how good you were at it, and I was good but not brilliant at it, you know, even if you were very, very strong and very quick, you couldn't win all the time because there were too many variables. It's a bit like motorsport. You had to learn to lose at a young age.
I've done that brilliantly well.
yeah, me too, to be fair. It was just, you know, I think that You couldn't get too carried away with it. Even the really quick guys, they would fall off. They would get knocked off. They would, you know, there was lots of variables. 8 guys going out of start and get into the first corner, all trying to, you know, to get the whole shot, get the lead, and, you know, inevitably crashes happen. So, at the age of 8, 9, 10, you're learning that, you know, it doesn't always go your way. That you've got to bounce back. You've got to be resilient. You've got to give your best. And even if you do, you know, there's no guarantees. So, I think it was a really good grounding, apart from the obvious, you know, bike handling and the actual physical side of things. I think mentally it was a great start.
Now, we've got a question here that sort of ties in quite nicely at the moment from Will Donaldson about your early cycling at Meadowbank, which is an early, well, it's in sort of 1980s, early 1980s Commonwealth Games track. But yep. It wasn't in the best of condition.
No, it was, well, they built the track for the 1970 Games, and then they redid it for the 1986 Games. And at the time, they had the opportunity to put a roof on it. And apparently there was this local entrepreneur, businessman who had the money and was willing to pay for the roof to be put on it if they'd called the velodrome after him. And the councillor said, no way. So they left the roof off it in Edinburgh, you know, which obviously is not renowned for its glorious weather all the time. And during the Commonwealth Games, it was rain, you know, literally, it was called the Wellydrome. That was what they nicknamed it. It was raining all week, and they only just got all the racing completed. So we inherited this amazing track. It was fantastic to have a velodrome in your home city, but it was just this common theme of you'd come down on a Tuesday night for track league, and you'd get warmed up, you'd go up for the first race, few spots of rain, and then it would downpour for, you know, 10 minutes, and the track would be wet for the next hour. You'd sit and wait for another hour. You'd just about get back out again, it would rain again, and it was incredibly frustrating, but it was a great track, and you know, I always remember that first feeling coming down the stairs under the tunnel and popping up in the track centre and just looking around at this incredible track, and it was really intimidating. All velodromes are the first time you go in when you're about to cycle on them. Super steep bankings, the TV never gives it, you know, that kind of sense of how steep they are. And yeah, I just loved it. It was one of these things, a bit like motorsport, that you try it once and you get hooked and you want to do it again and again.
I was going to ask, we'll talk more about cycling, but your introduction to motorsport, you know, was very much your sort of cycling career finish, and then you went into the Radical SR1 Cup.
That's it, yeah.
But you must have been very aware of motorsport long before your cycling career.
Yes, I was a huge fan of Colin McRae. Obviously, being Scottish, you know, we didn't have many world champions back in the 90s in any sport. But I think watching Colin and his style of driving, his full commitment, his just this infectious personality that you were drawn towards watching and supporting him. Colin, I have Colin to thank for my real kind of passion for motorsport. But even before then, you know, as a kid, I had a Skeletric set with the two 911 Le Mans cars with the lights that came on. And I remember asking my dad, you know, why do they have lights and the other cars don't? And he said, well, that's for Le Mans. It's a 24-hour race. They race through the night. And that was the first sort of spark of interest in Le Mans. So, yeah, I guess I've always been, you know, and Formula One as well. You can't avoid it. It's everywhere. And particularly in the 90s, it was 80s and 90s. It was, you know, big news all the time. So, yeah, it's something I've always been a fan of and passionate about, but never really even, it wasn't even a dream to compete. I just never thought it would be a possibility. It was so far away from reality that I would, why would I ever think I could get to compete, you know, on four wheels?
We'll talk about Le Mans in a bit, but you mentioned there, obviously, looking up to Colin McRae. With cycling, it was during your career that British cycling kind of just, you know, to those of us outside of it, it kind of re-emerged and was at the forefront of everyone's mind, and kind of young kids who were growing up when you were at the Olympics, they had people to emulate and people to look up to and say, oh, I want to do that. But when you started, certainly in Scotland, there wasn't really that. What was it that kind of hooked you and got you into?
I just think it was initially just the enjoyment of racing and riding on the track. It was a really fun thing to do. We had a really strong club and a great atmosphere, a good social side to the track racing scene, because when you're at a race, you sort of turn up, you get your little seat in the track centre, and then you do a race that lasts a few seconds or a few minutes, you come back down, you sit and chat, you're going up and down all day, so you spend a lot of time just sitting, talking, and you make a really, you know, strong sort of, you know, social network from that. So I enjoyed that part of it, but there was never any possibility of making it as, you know, an international or even doing it full time. Winning medals was just, you know, it was a pipe dream at that time. The biggest change, or I had one person to really look up to, one person that was achieving on the highest level without any support, and that was Graeme O'Bree, who was this Scottish sort of maverick rider who competed against Chris Boardman in the early 90s. And Chris had full factory support. He had, you know, the big sponsors. He had Peter Keane, who was this sports scientist who had all the new ideas, revolutionary ways to train. And Graham built his own bikes with his own two hands. He actually welded bits of scrap metal together. He got an old washing machine and took the bearing, because his philosophy was, well, a washing machine spins at, you know, 1200 RPM, so I'm only pedaling at 150 RPM, so these bearings must be really good. So I'm going to take these bearings out of this washing machine and use them in my bike. He looked at, you know, even things like how wide he wanted his knees to be, how close he wanted to get them together to be as aero as possible. And this is all without wind tunnels and any kind of support. And he decided that he had to build this special narrow bottom bracket and use these bearings for it. He changed his whole riding position. He went into a skier's position, so he tucked his arms up instead of having arms in front. Changed everything, came out, and he won the world title, broke the world record, beat Chris Boardman. The governing body were absolutely shocked by this, and they said, well, you know, we can't have an amateur coming out and breaking all these records. So they banned the position that he was riding in. So he went away and thought about it and came back with a second position that was known as the Superman position, with his arms straight in front, and he broke the record again, became world champion again. Just an amazing, amazing guy. If you ever get a chance, there's a film called The Flying Scotsman, and Johnny Lee Miller plays Graham in the film, and it's quite, you know, it's an amazing, amazing film. It's very true to the real story, to his life. He's written a book about his life as well, his autobiography. And there's some sad bits in it too. He struggled with mental illness in his life and attempted suicide and all sorts. But it's, yeah, it's a really poignant story, and Graham's still going strong now, and he's still my hero. So yeah, Graham is an amazing guy. So if anyone gets a chance to do a bit more research about him, I would thoroughly recommend it.
That is exactly what I'm going to be doing after this, actually. But it's funny, isn't it? There's kind of parallels with motorsport and cycling. You know, it's the underdog story that people love, and ingenuity does get you sort of to the front. I really want to talk about the kind of the British team's mentality and how you found sort of nths of seconds in a bit. But am I right in thinking you were almost a professional rower?
So
you were on the junior team, which is a lot further than I've ever
been. I loved rowing. I did it at school. I represented Scotland at the junior level at the home countries.
I'll say that's almost professional. from my perspective.
It was, I loved rowing, and I do miss it, actually. And I got a chance to go rowing with Steve Redgrave a couple of years ago. I did a documentary about various sportsmen and women who were very successful, and I was interviewing them and asking them about what made them champions. And I got to go out in a pair with Steve Redgrave on the canal in Edinburgh, where I used to row from my old boat club. And that was a dream come true.
Now, it's kind of once you were sort of fully professional, a track cyclist, when you were saying that you never in your wildest dreams could imagine, you know, winning Olympic medals, being world champion 11 times, when did the penny drop? Was it the first medal, or was it the first gold? Or?
Yeah, I think it was. There was a couple of moments, really. First of all, to make it happen, you had to have the support. We didn't have any support. We didn't have any financial backing. The velodrome being built in Manchester was crucial, because it was an indoor track, so you could train 12 months of the year. Up until that point, you couldn't train, you know, in the winter months.
Not at Meadowbank.
Exactly. So we had this facility, and that was great, but then we didn't have the money to rent it out. So British Cycling had two full-time members of staff, and that was it. At the rest of the time, you know, they would have, I think they had two weekends a month that they could afford to rent the velodrome. So we had this facility, but we couldn't use it. So there were cat shows, there were Tory party conferences, there were cheerleading competitions, all sorts of stuff happening in the track centre, but we couldn't afford to rent the track out to use it. So I was at university in St Andrews. I was coming down twice a month to train for 3 days in a row, and the rest of the time just training on indoor trainers or out on the road. And, you know, there's no way you can compete against the top guys in the world doing it that way. But it was in 1997, end of 97, beginning of 98, the National Lottery started, and the lottery fund was created for sport and for good causes. So it meant that we were given this, very fortunate to receive this grant, you know, an annual grant. I got £10,000, which meant I could pay my rent, I could pay for travel up and down to Manchester, I could pay for food, and it was a lifeline. It was like £1 million. It was like this, you know, this opportunity to go professional. So I left university when I graduated in 99, went full time on the bike, thinking it might happen for a year or two. And I guess it was in 2000, I got to the Olympics as part of the team sprint. And it was when I saw my teammate Jason Queeley win the gold in the kilo. That was the point when I suddenly thought, well, he's just Jason. He's just my teammate. He's a normal guy. He's got two arms, two legs. He's not some sort of superhuman who I kind of maybe put the Olympic champions up on a pedestal before that point, and realized that, you know, it's possible. And I didn't think I was the same level as Jason, but I thought, well, if he can do it, maybe potentially in a few years' time, I could be close to that. And to have the Olympic champion in your team to train with every day to help sort of drag you up to that level, that was a huge opportunity.
Just fast forwarding to the 2004 Olympics in Athens and the sea level kilo. So the kilo for readers who don't know or listeners who don't know, is basically the kilometre.
That's right, yeah. 1,000 metres against the clock. You're not racing, just one rider. It's a time trial, one race. There's no heats, no qualifying. So you turn up and it's just everything in over four laps, and it's the most painful thing you can possibly do. I mean, it's only a minute, but the pain that you can put yourself through in those last 20 seconds, it's indescribable. So yeah, it's the race of truth. You know, there's no hiding, there's no tactics, there's no room for interpretation. It's just all out for 1 minute.
And but that particular one, you were didn't you get injured 2 weeks before? You went last.
Yeah, I was last. It was reverse order in seeding. So I'd won the world championships the year before, and it basically you kind of sit there and watch your competitors post their times. And yeah, about 7 days before, I crashed in the village on the bike. My last sort of ride, I just finished a training session on the indoor bike. I'd gone out for a little cool down ride around the village, came up to a roundabout, and there was this bus driver coming towards the roundabout. I had right to wave, but he just kept coming, and I had to sort of try and get through in front of him because I thought he's going to hit me. And I went too fast around the roundabout, hot tarmac in Athens, slid out and had a bit of a tumble. Thankfully, it was just road rash and, nothing too serious, but it was one of those moments you think, God, you could have easily broken a wrist or a collarbone and that would have been the game's over. So I was very lucky there. On the night itself, it was just, one of these things you look back on now and it's great with hindsight, but at the time it was terrifying because four riders to go, the Australian rider Shane Kelly, he broke the world records. I had to stand there and watch him break the world record, go faster than anyone had ever gone before. The next guy, Stefan Nimka from Germany, did it again. And then right before I went to the start line, the Frenchman Arnaud Tourneau, my big rival, he went under 61 seconds for the first time ever. And it was just this feeling of, right now, a personal best will only get me fourth place. And if you start dwelling on that and thinking about it too much, you're kind of like a rabbit in the headlights. So it was just about focusing on the process of what I had to do to get the best ride from myself, not worry about the times. I had no control over that at all, and really just block everything out. You focus on exactly what you wanted to do to get the best result, and thankfully it worked out.
And but you broke the world record pretty much on every lap.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you're not pacing it. It's not like in longer events the coach would stand at the side and would give you feedback on how fast you're going, and you ride to a schedule. But because it's essentially a sprint, you're just kind of going all out. But every split, every time you come round at the end of each lap, for the four laps, you get the split that goes up on the screen. And you don't see that, but you can hear the crowd respond to what's happening on the... So, yeah, I kind of... At the end of the first lap, was a huge roar. And I remember thinking... There's only two things, actually, I can remember from the race. I remember thinking, that's brilliant, I must be up. And then the second thought that popped into my head was, wait a minute.
Maybe they're French supporters.
Well, exactly. Because I was in Stuttgart 2 years before, and at every split, there was a huge roar. And I crossed the line... Massive roar. I looked up at the scoreboard and I was fourth, and it was because I was down on the Germans' time. They were cheering for the Germans, so I remember thinking, they might not be cheering for you, just keep going. And then the rest is a bit of a blur, really. I've watched the video so many times over the years that your memory becomes the video. You start to lose that first person perspective, and you just remember what the video and the commentary. I could give you the commentary back from Hugh Porter word for word virtually. But it's funny. I mean, that's what, 15 years ago now. So almost a lifetime ago in many ways to what's happened since then. But yeah.
So how do you train for something that lasts for a minute? That is kind of full power.
Yeah.
So I can't remember. There was a TV program, I'm sure, where you got onto a bike and they wanted to see what your max wattage was, mm-hmm. and you'd literally like a few strokes to the leg, mm-hmm. and that was it, mm-hmm. and the wattage was off the chart.
So basically what you would do, if you got like any event you're training for, you would assess the kind of energy systems that you're using within your body. So because I'm not doing the Tour de France or long distance stuff, I don't need to have that aerobic efficiency. I need to have the ability to produce as much energy in as short a space of time as possible. So within that minute, you need to have the power and the strength to get the bike off the line, to accelerate up to speed. You've got one gear, and it's a big old gear, so you need to have a lot of torque to get that bike going. So you do a lot of strength work, maximal strength work, really explosive power. you need to have the ability to hit high peak power, which is, you know, obviously different to torque. So you train for maybe sort of doing 5 to 10 second efforts that produce a lot of power in a very short space of time. And then you have to have the ability to hang on to the speed once the fatigue sets in. So after about 20 seconds, the lactic acid in your muscles starts to build up and up and up. And then within the last, probably the last 15 or 20 seconds, the last lap and a half, your body is, it's like it's drowning in lactic acid. You're kind of gone beyond this point where you can, I mean, it's the pain is hard to explain. And, if you actually look at the power trace, you hit peak power after about 3 or 4 seconds, and then the power just continuously comes down and down and down. Even though the speed is actually relatively consistent, relatively constant, the power comes down and down and down. So at the end, you're probably crossing the line at doing about 300 watts. And you're peaking at about 2,500 watts. So it's this fatigue gradient, which, you know, it's, and if you do it more efficiently, if you did a kind of flatter curve, you would never get up to a high enough peak speed. So you have to, you front load it. You put so much effort into that first lap and then hang on. And it's grim. It's one of the hardest things, you know, trying to explain how sore it is. And you, I guess you think, well, but you're professional, you train for that. You know, you should be fit enough that you can deal with that. But the more power you can produce, the more pain it causes. So it's almost like the fitter you get, the harder you can push yourself. So, but it's the training we do to sort of create the lactic acid, you do very short efforts, maybe 30 second efforts with a minute recovery, and you do that 4 times in a row. So sprint for 30 seconds, rest for 60, sprint for 30, rest for 60, 4 times, and then you would just collapse off the bike and lie in a kind of fetal position for usually about 15 minutes. And as you're lying there, your body feels like, you know, something's wrong here. I shouldn't be feeling this bad. I'm never doing this again. You know, I'm clearly ill. I'm going to have a day off. And then you get out of that sort of 15 minutes and you pop out and you feel fine. You go, right, okay, let's do another set. And you just do it again and again. And yeah, there were some days where you'd come out of the training session in the lab, just you and the coach, no one watching you, no crowds, nobody has witnessed any of it. But you would feel almost as elated as some days when you've won other races, just because you'd made a progression of 5 watts or 10 watts over your personal best. So it was always, everything was measurable. There was nowhere to hide. You couldn't just sort of come in and go, yeah, I gave it everything today. And you go, well, hang on a minute, let's look at the data. You didn't.
No, you didn't.
So yeah, it's there's parts of my career I really miss, but that definitely isn't one of them. I mean, it's, yeah, a lot of pain.
So it's the fitness, we've got a question here from Matt Stelmacher, and it's kind of related to this, and he's asking what the key skill is that you've been able to bring from cycling into long distance endurance racing. And I'm guessing it's more the Kieran in terms of the actual racing with other people.
Yeah, the biggest thing is the ability to focus and the ability to block out distractions. So it's exactly the same, you know, like in the Kieran or the Kilo at the start. If you start dwelling on what happens if I win, what happens if I lose, he's looking like it's going to be fast today, or, you know, the conditions or the crowd, or as soon as you're looking at things that have absolutely no bearing on your own performance, it's taking your mental concentration away from that. So in the car, if I'm coming towards a corner, coming towards Porsche curves at Le Mans at night, thinking I'm doing 140 miles an hour here, you know, this is supposed to be just a lift and turn in, that wall looks pretty close, you know, if I get this wrong, oh, there might be oil here, what happens if I hit, you know, if I hit the wall, it'll be a disaster. As soon as you dwell on the things that could go wrong, it massively increases your chance of doing that. So, you know, even in mountain biking, if you're going down a hill, the key thing is always to look exactly where you want to go. You don't look at the things you're trying to avoid.
Which is the same in motor racing, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So you focus on the line, you try and increase your vision, you try and look through the corner, and these are the things that I knew from cycling that I passed across to motorsport, but they're completely different skills. So, you know, it's, you come into it and you have the competitive instinct, you have the desire to go fast, you have the desire to win, but yeah, you learn very quickly that it's going to be, you're starting at the very, very bottom level. But that's part of what drew me to it. I quite enjoyed the thought of a new challenge that every time I get in the car, I'm going to be significantly better. Whereas on the bike, you know, you were spending a whole year or 4 year cycle trying to improve maybe half a tenth of a second. You know, the margins were so small, you were so close to the top level that you didn't have the headroom to improve. But in the car, I've got a long way to improve, which is good.
And were you surprised by the sort of the physicality of racing? Because for lots of people and lots of my friends always ask, why do racing drivers have to be so fit? Because they ultimately sit in a car and they turn it.
I think it depends on the type of car. I think it depends on your level. So you could get somebody who has huge amount of experience and skill, and they could go around without, you know, barely raising their heart rate and barely breaking a sweat. But for me, I just stepped off being a full-time professional athlete at the Olympic level, and I would jump into a car and I would come out of the car just exhausted, sweating and completely shattered. But the fatigue wasn't coming from the physical effort of using your muscles to turn the steering wheel or apply the brake. It was the concentration, it was the stress, it was your brain was working at full capacity, just trying to deal with all this information, and you get out the car and you're exhausted. But I think the more skillful you are, the more you can do stuff automatically, the more natural it is to you. If you've been driving carts since you were 5 and you're now, you know, in your teens or 20s and you're a pro driver, you do it, you know, you're on autopilot when you're doing the racing, and you're using your brain to think about strategy or think ahead or deal with other things. So the physical side, until you get up to the cars, have a lot of downforce. It's not that physically hard, but it's hugely hard in terms of your concentration, emotions, everything. You come out of the car and you're shattered.
It's interesting what you were saying about the focus, though. And obviously, as an Olympian, you have that that ability to focus absolutely on something. And I was doing a little bit of kind of digging around in terms of you're obviously doing Le Mans and things like that. So you were the first summer Olympian to compete at Le Mans, but you were actually the 9th former Olympian at Le Mans, and the second Olympian champion to do so.
Wow. So is it mainly winter sports?
It's winter sports, the skiing that seems to translate.
That's interesting.
To motor racing. Yeah. But there's obviously something there coming from the Olympics to motor racing.
I guess it's, you know, you have athletes who have focused on one thing, and they're incredibly driven and they have the desire to aim towards a goal and work towards something, and then they retire, and then it's this feeling of, well, what next? And you can have other focuses, and it's good to have a bit of variety and a bit of balance in your life when you've gone from doing one thing to the nth degree. You know, it's nice to have a more of a normal life, but you do miss that challenge and that focus. And motorsport, I think it's high up on the list because it's just a fun thing to do, and it's an opportunity that if you get the chance to do it, you want to grab it with both hands. But I think you could see why skiers or bobsleigh guys or anybody that's involved in a high-speed, highly skillful sport that needs to think ahead and plan ahead, the translation into motorsport would be pretty good, yeah.
So just before we kind of move on to the motorsport side of it, I wanted to talk about 2012, obviously the London Olympics. It's kind of in some senses, a dream come true for you, having the Olympics in London. You retired the following year, so I guess you always knew this was your final.
Yeah, ideally, I would love to have gone on to Glasgow for the Commonwealth Games in 2014, but I think my body had just about had enough of all those nasty sessions in the lab and everything else. It was, yeah, I in many ways, looking back now, you kind of gloss over the tough times. So in 2008, it was in a fantastic Games. I got 3 gold medals in Beijing. And it was, you know, just a very significant moment in my career. But then shortly afterwards, when I came back into training, went to the first race after the Olympics, and I crashed and really damaged my hip quite badly. And I was off the bike for 10 weeks, missed the World Championships. And then from then on, it was quite a struggle just to actually get to London to be selected, because only one rider per nation per event was allowed. They changed the rules.
That was slightly in light of how well Britain was doing.
Yeah,
which,
I mean,
if you told everyone 20 years before that was going to happen.
I mean, we weren't even, you know, a B or a C grade nation in Britain. We were just, you know, the bottom of the pile, basically, back in the day. And then to think that within 15 years, we'd managed to become such a dominant nation that the powers that be didn't want us to be winning gold and silver in each event. They wanted just one person. But if you imagine in athletics saying, well, one Jamaican, one American, you know, you're not allowed to have more than one per nation, there would be an outcry, because you want the best athletes in the world to be at the Olympic Games. So they changed this. They changed it after London, which didn't really help me. But for London, it meant that, you know, I had a teammate in Jason Kenny who was the quickest in the world. The two of us were kind of 1 and 2 in the world in the 2 individual events. So the choice had to be made. Do we, you know, divide and conquer, or does one person get the chance to do both events? And in the end, it was the right choice, I think. You know, I'd love to have defended all 3 titles, but Jason was going better than me in the sprint. I was going better than him in the Kieran. And together we joined forces with Philip Hines and we won the team sprint. So I got 2 gold medals. Jason got 2 and Phil got his 1 in the team sprint. But it was the dream ending. And I think the Athens up until that point was the most dramatic night. It was the, you know, the first time you become Olympic champion. Everything about that night was so special. I never thought anything could compare to it. But the final night, winning the Keirin, it was the last event of the track program. So everybody had sort of gathered in the track center to watch it. The stands were full. It was, by the nature of the event, it's a very unpredictable thing to win. And yeah, it was like within inches of all being over. The German rider, my main rival, Max Levy, he almost passed me with a half lap to go. And if he just cleared my front wheel, he could have come down and shut the door. But I just managed to hang on, prevent that overlap or keep that overlap there. And then through the last corner, held the line on the inside and came past him. And the roar, I mean, the noise that night, I'll never forget that. Just, you know, you talk about the effect of a home crowd. It was something special. And then I won the gold medal, standing behind the podium, waiting for the presentation. Normally, once I got on and you hear the anthems, then the little tear comes out. I couldn't even hold it in before I got onto the podium. I was in an absolute mess because I was picking out faces in the crowd. I could see, you know, obviously my coaches and the support team, but then you see other guys that, you know, your rivals, they're coaches. You see friends and family in the stand. You see people that have been there since the very beginning. And I guess I had this moment to sort of flashback through my whole career, realizing this is the last moment I'm going to step on the podium at the Olympic Games. I thought back to Sydney in 2000 when I got a silver medal with the team. At the time, thinking if this is all I ever get in my career, I'll be happy. To finish with six golds and a silver, and just to be so grateful I'd had this fantastic career, so many great memories, it was the perfect send-off. And it was having that home Olympics that really inspired me for the last two or three years, which were very tough, to get to the Games, to keep working, just to experience that moment.
I remember watching that race standing up in front of the TV.
Really?
Yeah. There's no one was sitting down in the room. But there was that, the wonderful thing about the British, the London Olympics, was just this amazing feeling of goodwill. And I was in the Olympic Village a couple of times to watch some of the sports, and it was just an amazing atmosphere. And it was, yeah, I mean, what a way to sign out.
It's kind of sad because you think, well, you know, that was 7 years ago, and you think, look at our country now and look at the country then. We were so united, and it was such a feeling of, do you know what, look at what we can achieve, and wow, isn't this great? And there were so many doubters leading into the Games. The transport's going to be terrible, the weather's going to be awful, we're not going to win any medals, it's going to be a disaster. And almost from the moment of the start of the opening ceremony, when it all kicked off, and everybody sat back and thought this is really good, and wow, you know, it's not rained yet, and look at all the crowds, and it was just a wonderful time. People were talking on the tube, and you know, I used to open the curtains on the balcony. We were on the edge of the village. We had a really nice spot, top floor, and it looked across onto the main stadium. And every morning you'd open your curtains and you see these tens of thousands of people flooding into Olympic Park. And it was just, you know, trying to soak it in and realize, you know what, this is a temporary thing. This is for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You know, this is something you'll remember for the rest of your life. And yeah, it was a magical time. And I even getting to carry the flag in for the opening ceremony myself. I remember thinking at the time, if this is all I get from these Games, if I don't win a medal, the last 4 years of hard work has been worth it to get to this point. Because when you walk in and you hear David Bowie, Heroes, and the crowd goes wild, and you realize that you're leading in the nation at the home Olympic Games, you know, these are the things that when you're growing up, you just assume will happen to someone else. You never think it's going to happen to you. So yeah, it was a magical time. And it is sad when you think that, you know, in such a short space of time, the country's so divided, and there's so many things that, you know, you turn the news on and you think, oh God, you know, can it get any worse? But yeah, let's have another Olympic Games, shall we?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that'll sort it out. Sport unites. So moving on to motorsport, you were saying how obviously the ability to focus was a huge help. Some of the kind of your racing tactics from the Keirin helped. Was there something you struggled with when you first took a car on track?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think the biggest thing was understanding that, you know, there are so many more variables. Certainly when I started racing, it was about, you can't control the end result. You know, it doesn't matter how well prepared you are or the car is. There's so many things that can go right or go wrong. The fact that cars just break, you know, components break out of nowhere, and it could be on the last lap. But look at Toyota in, you know, at Le Mans. It's just, you know, to get that far in a 24-hour race, and it's not just about the 24-hour race, it's about the whole year, or sometimes 5-6 years building up to that moment of developing the car, getting the team together, everything that goes towards such a huge, huge challenge. And it can go wrong anytime, at any stage. And it's understanding that and realizing that you you can't focus on the end result. Again, bringing it back to cycling, focus on the process of what you need to do, and understanding that, yeah, don't worry about the end result. It'll take care of itself. Winning or losing, it's not irrelevant. That's the aim is to win, but the aim is to go out there personally and do the best job you can. But in terms of driving on track, I think it was initially very committed, overly committed, and making lots of mistakes. And I was encouraged to do that by, I had Andy Wallace, who was my instructor at Radical, and Roger Green. And they were saying, yeah, if you're not spinning, you're not trying hard enough, to keep going. And then it's getting to the point where you realize actually,
when you're upside down in a barrier.
Yes, exactly.
Andy, you're sacked.
Yeah. But he was great. He used to sit with me in the passenger seat, and, you know, we had a spin at Bedford, and he said, oh, don't worry, it's a great place, there's nothing to hit. But the one place there is a wall, there's a kind of pit wall coming down the back straight, not pit wall, just a tire wall. And I touched the white line on braking, and it was a little bit damp still, and I spun the car, and it was like, you know, tire wall, grass. Spun it, missed the wall, came to a stop, and he just turned to me and said, well, that was exciting. You did very well, you put your foot on the clutch, you know. And I was like, my heart rate was like about 180. I was thinking, God. But yeah, he's a legend, Andy. But he was really great help in the early days. And just, I guess, in a car like the Radical SR1, it's actually not got a lot of downforce. A lot of people assume they're similar to the SR3 or the SR8. Very low grip, so the car's moving around. So you do learn a lot about the dynamics of the car and about your inputs and how they affect that. But I just find it so exciting, and I loved the speed, and I loved the focus, and I loved the fact that, like cycling, when I was in the car on track, nothing else in the world was existing apart from the next breaking point, the next apex. You know, it was just, you immerse yourself in this experience, and you finish, and you kind of, it's almost like you've come up for air. You're like, oh yeah, there's something else happening in the world today. It's not just about driving a car on a track. It's it was a fantastic experience.
So when you started, were you thinking, right, I'm going to see if I can get Le Mans. We'll see how it goes. Or was that something that came later? Was it just some fun to start with?
Well, it was just for the sake of doing it. And it was filming a documentary about Colm McRae.
Which was excellent, by the way.
Oh, thank you. It was a real privilege to do it, and quite difficult to do it as well, because, you know, you're going in to meet his family who, you know, have, since Colin's accident, they didn't really want to speak to the media too much, understandably. But they welcomed me in, and, you know, it's just so much fun with Jimmy, you know, all the adventures. He's still a hooligan at heart, and taking me out and just, you know, embracing, you know, bringing me in and, you know, welcoming to the family, and just, yeah, they were fantastic. But the first day, I remember going to the filming up at the farm and just thinking, this is tricky, because, you know, they're welcoming a film crew into their home, and they're going to talk about something that's still very, very raw. But it was, yeah, a privilege to do. So it was filming that documentary that we did a little scene of me out on the track at Alton Park in my own track car in the Lotus 211. And Roger Green came down. He was at the time, I'd just finished working at Evo, and he was working for Radical. And I was a big fan of Evo and reading, you know, obviously Motorsport as well.
Well, of course, yeah. There are no other magazines.
And I went over and chatted to Roger, and he said, you know, have you thought about racing? And I said, well, not really, because, you know, I mean, I have no idea how you get into it. He said, well, we can get you out in a car, you know, do some testing, and if you like it, we can get you through your ARDS test, and there's a novice race series starting next year we're going to run, and we'd love to put you in a car for that. So it all spiraled from that documentary about Colin. So at that point, I think it was when we were testing, and Andy, you know, I was introduced to Andy, and they said, well, you know, if you keep on this, you could, Le Mans is an achievable goal, you know, because you can go there as an amateur driver. And I just dismissed that. I thought, oh, yeah, whatever, you know, I'll stick with the SR1 to start off with. And then it was in 2015 when I was working with Nissan as part of their Olympic partnership. And they said, you know, we'll have a look at you, see what you like in the car. And when we did a test, they said, well, let's make the end goal Le Mans. You know, got 3 years to get there. And they were, you know, amazing at bringing through gamers through to, you know, the highest level professional drivers. So they had a chance, I had a chance to sort of piggyback that program, the GT Academy. And it was, yeah, just this pipe dream initially. And as the time went on, and the, you know, they progressed through the ranks, did British GT, European Le Mans series. And then it was, you know, we're going to do Le Mans next year. And that was when I got the phone call to say it's on, and we've got the team, and we've got the car. It suddenly sort of dawned on me, I'm going to do this. This is going to be me out there. So really, really exciting.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And obviously, you're very used to walking into stadiums and performing in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people. You knew about Le Mans, you're obviously a fan of it and things like that. But I think a lot of drivers, even sort of professional racing drivers who have raced from the age of six, still find it amazing when you arrive there and the enormity of it. And it's not so much the place, it's the whole week that goes with it. Was that
absolutely
the same with you, even with
100%? And it was the best thing I did was go there the year before, and they allowed LMP3 cars to test on the official test day, which they hadn't before. So I got to drive. I mean, it was absolutely atrocious day that was just rain nonstop the whole time. But to get on the track and to experience all that time
at Meadowbank.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it prepared
me
for.
I'm like a rain magnet. But it was, yeah, it was before you even get there, you're driving down and then you see your first sign for Le Mans and you suddenly go, wow, you know, and the road signs, it's just so many things that bring the emotion and just the romance to behind the event. And you get there and then you recognize all these things you've seen on TV. And I've been before, you know, as a fan to watch two or three times before, and to be arriving there with a view to actually getting in the car and getting on the track is a very different feeling to arriving there as a fan. But yeah, I remember going out and just pulling out the pit lane, and it, you know, even as a kid with a Skeletric set with a Dunlop bridge and all the things that you know, like, wow, I'm going under the Dunlop bridge for the first time. But for me, it was heading down the Mulsanne straight the first time, and you're sitting there pinned flat to the floor just thinking, here we go, this is it, I'm on the Mulsanne straight. And then before you know it, you see these huge lights behind you and it's Mark Webber and an LMP1 just going God almighty. But yeah, it was, everything about Le Mans was special. And you know, and there were so many stages to it as well. It wasn't like the novelty wears off. The, you know, for me, one of the best points was the nighttime stint, the first night stint I went out on, and you pull out the pits in the dark and head down, and that was just one of the highlights, without doubt, thinking, this is, you know, one of the moments of my life. This is something I'll always remember. And what a privilege as well, because so many people want to do it, and not just your average fan who goes there and says, I wonder what it'd be like to be in the track, but you know, really high level professional drivers who have dedicated their lives to this profession and they still haven't had the opportunity to do it. So here's me, some numpty that used to ride bikes, you know, getting this chance to go out in an LMP2 car. I wanted to do the whole opportunity justice and not just turn up and take it lightly. So yeah, for all the people that were wanting to be or would love to be in my shoes, I wanted to do the best job I could.
And what was the kind of, from when you first stepped into a car in terms of the SR1 and then sort of race capacity through to Le Mans and things that you've done since, what's been the feedback like from the sort of motorsport community? Were they a bit difficult to start with? Or
no, I think they were. I was really warmly welcomed. I think I genuinely think that the motorsport community love it when people come in from other, you know, areas, because it reaches a wider audience and people will take an interest in motorsport that maybe hadn't before and appreciate how hard it is and how amazing it is. And you know, that I guess most people, if they're not into motorsport, they'll be aware of motorsport through F1. You know, every weekend through the summer they'll see F1 on the telly, and they'll see these onboard shots of just the steering wheel and then turn and the car goes that way and straight and turn. And you think, well, I drive a car every day. I go to drop the kids off at school. I can drive, so I could pretty much do what Lewis Hamilton does. And they have no concept of just the nuances, the skill, the fact the cars are on the, you know, whether it's a Formula One car or, you know, Caterhams or whatever, any kind of championship in between. Every driver is pushing to the limit on every part of the circuit, and it's such a challenge and so exciting. And I just think TV doesn't ever quite do it justice. So if you can get out there and spread the word and talk about it and people think, well, he seems quite passionate about this, it must be quite exciting, then hopefully you're doing a very small job to sort of spread the word.
And what, you know, we were talking earlier about your, you know, your kilo races, a minute, a maximum effort. A 24-hour race in a car is a hugely different thing, and I suppose Nissan would have kind of got you prepared for that. Was there anything that you found surprising in that process in terms of the lead to the 24-hour
event? I think it was about trying to just break it into segments, so understanding that you don't think about it as a 24-hour race. You think, right, okay, I'm going to do... We're starting off with a double stint at 5 o'clock, and then you're going to be back in the car at 11 o'clock, or, you know, and that's going to be a triple stint. Therefore, you know, that's going to be roughly X number of laps. And you, during that time, you know, it's never thinking too far ahead. So you're never thinking, oh my God, I've been in the car for 5 minutes and I'm just, you know, I'm absolutely at capacity here. I can't deal with this. It's so intense. You know, you just think about... it's almost like a hurdles race. You don't think about the hurdle you've just gone over or the one that's five or six down the line. It's just, what's next? What am I doing next? Right, over this, onto the next one. And you just, it's just like a conveyor belt, one by one, minute by minute, lap by lap. And then before you know it, you get the call, box this lap, and you're coming in, and you're like, it passed in the blink of an eye. You know, a 2.5 hour stint can just go like that, which seems crazy. But the key to it, I guess, is relaxing at the points that you can relax on. And Le Mans actually... probably a less physical circuit than many. For a 24-hour race, you've got these, it's almost like flurries of activity and then recover, and then flurries of activity and recover. But in that time, you have to keep an eye on all the different dials and make sure everything's operating okay in the car. You've got to communicate with your engineer. You've got to be super aware about what's happening around you, because, you know, we've seen so many accidents at Le Mans with the huge speed differentials between the categories. So when you're going along at night, or even in the daytime, and you see the big bright white lights of the LMP1 coming up behind
you, blinding lights,
they are blinding.
Usefully.
Yeah, so you can't even look at them. So as soon as you see your mirrors light up, you don't look in the mirror. The road ahead lights up, so you know they're coming, and you hold your line, and it's just like you kind of almost shut your eyes and hold your breath. But the worst moment for me the first time was when I assumed it was just two. I could see it was more than one set of lights. I thought, right, there's two coming up behind. And one went past, and the second went past, and I almost came back on the racing line, and there was a third, and it was just, and then I thought, you know, it wasn't close in terms of I didn't actually make the move, but it was close enough for me. I was about to make that move, so it was a great lesson of, right, you do not do that until you're 100% sure. You know, it's just, it doesn't bear thinking about if you get it wrong there. And apart from anything else, imagine being the person that ended the hopes of one of the Porsches or the Audis or the...
Well, it's happened many Toyotas. Times.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want to be that guy. So it was, yeah, it's... I guess you just don't think too far ahead. You think about one lap at a time, one breaking point at a time, and then before you know it, you're called in, and that's the end of your stint.
And do you have an engineer on the radio, though, saying the lead battle's coming up behind you? Do you get a bit of feedback on that?
Because yeah,
obviously on a bicycle, you absolutely did not.
Some engineers and some teams are better at that than others. You know, some communicate really well. And even down to the simplicity of, you know, at Le Mans, the radio didn't work that well. So you had sections of the track where you could communicate and sections where you couldn't.
This is the cutting edge of motorsport.
Exactly. Well, yeah, we had all sorts of problems. And so on my first stint, I think on the second lap coming into the Mulsanne corner at the end of the straight, I locked up, and a really bad lock up on the front right, really bad flat spot, to the point where, you know, you can't see out the windscreen, though it's vibrating so badly. And I'm thinking, and every time you get to a breaking point, it locks up on the same bit, makes it worse, and you're just absolutely paranoid that I was going to go through the canvas and I was going to get a puncture, and it was, you know, going to be off at the start of the race. So I said, you know, I've got a flat spot, really bad, I've got to come in. But I had to wait till we came back into the zone that I could actually communicate. And the engineer was saying, well, you know, you've cocked the tires up, you have to wait and see, you know, we're discussing. And it turns out they didn't have any tires, hot tires ready to go. So they're having, and I watched the documentary afterwards, where there was a documentary about the whole process of doing Le Mans. And there's this sort of comedy scene where you've got the head chief mechanic and the head engineer shouting at each other, where's the tire? We haven't got any tires. What cold ones? Well, you should have them. Just change one tire. They do that in Formula One. No, they don't. Yes, they do. Meanwhile, I'm like, am I coming in or not? And then it's like, but when you push the button, if they're talking, then you can't talk. Basically, I push the button to talk, and you can hear that they're discussing back and forth. So I couldn't say, am I coming in? It was just really stressful. For the first stint, it was the worst possible start. Eventually, I came in, and they changed all four tires, and they were cold. And I pulled out the pit lane, off the limiter, foot down, and the car stepped sideways, and I was like, whoa! And then 2 seconds later, Chris, your tires are cold, so be careful. I was like, yep, thank you. Just spotted that. So it got better from there, but that was quite a start to my first experience at Le Mans, yeah.
Baptism of fire. I would like to say I've had a very similar experience, but my only 24-hour race was the Citroën 2CV one at Snetterton.
Awesome.
So really no insight at all into Le Mans.
But it
lasted for the same amount of time.
The thing is, I don't think it matters what the car is or what the division is. It's the same camaraderie, the same experience, the same build-up. And did you finish the race?
Yeah, so interestingly, I went to bed at kind of 11 and I was supposed to be back in the car at sort of 5, 6 in the morning, but I got woken up at 1 in the morning sleeping in a tent in the paddock.
Yeah.
Because one of the drivers couldn't actually see at night in the rain, which only became apparent at sort of 1 in the morning, so I had to get back in the car. But it's great. And watching sunrise, it's just, there's something about a 24-hour race that's very, very magical.
Exactly.
Did
you get emotional at the end when you crossed the line? Did you feel you'd really achieved something?
Yeah, I did. But with Citroën TCVs, I know they've got lots of fans, but the Wellington Straight at Snetterton is very, very long.
You can send an email.
And you can look over to someone next to you to give them a wave. So it's a different form of racing. But it was a wonderful experience. And to get through it was incredible. It was really, really good.
Awesome.
So it's kind of fast forwarding a bit to what you're doing now. You've done so much in motorsport. It's quite amazing, actually. It's just really in 6 short years. Have you tested a Formula E car?
I don't know if you can call it a test. I did a couple of laps at Rome this year. So, I'm doing a series of sort of, basically it's me going in and trying different forms of motorsport.
It's a great way to try lots of different forms of motorsport.
It's a great excuse, isn't it? It's kind of, how do I get a chance to drive all these cars that I really want to drive? We could pretend that we are making a real TV series, honest. But yeah, basically I go in there. So there's World Rallycross, Formula E, Monster Trucks, which was insane. Doing some drifting, doing Gymkhana and Porsche Super Cup. So all these different forms, meeting different people who have the best jobs in the world as racing drivers and trying their cars out. So yeah, the tricky thing is that you have maybe one test day, in some cases no preparation, you go straight in and you just do it. So you've got to really learn quickly and on your feet, but you're not going to complain when you get the chance to drive. I mean, I did one test day at Pembrey and then I was in at the top end in the supercar category at the World Rallycross against, you know, Timmy Hansen, Kevin Hansen, Marcus Grönholm's son, you know, the best guys in the world. And you're sitting on the start line doing your little burnout before you get up there, you know, handbrake on, 600 horsepower, bouncing off the limiter. And there's like six of you looking across thinking, what on earth am I doing here? Handbrake off you go. And it was, I think the Rallycross experience has got to be up there with anything I've done in motorsport. It was absolutely brilliant and such a warm, friendly paddock as well. I mean, everywhere in motorsport it's always friendly, but these guys were just really glad to have someone in and were interested in what I was doing. And you know, yeah, the team with Ollie Bennett's team, they were fantastic too. So yeah, it was a great experience.
You're a very humble man for sort of people listening and watching as the Super Cup, which is widely regarded as one of the most competitive and quite a niche championship. You need to know what you're doing. You know you performed really well in it.
Well, thank you. It was, again, you know, I spoke to Chris Harris because he did it last year and, you know, he said, look, mate, you're going to be at the back end of things. Don't worry about that. It's tough. The guy, you know, these are pro drivers. The cars are tricky things to handle. No ABS, no traction, and it's all about the braking and it's easy to lock up. So he put the willies up me a little bit at the start.
Cheers, Chris.
Exactly. But it was great because you do go in there with very low expectations and they have what they call the VIP car. They have different sort of guests in usually once a year to drive it. And there was a great team, really professional. I had a test at Silverstone and I was about 4 seconds off the pace. And then by quali at Silverstone at the race, I was 2.7 off pole. So I was delighted with that, you know, on a sort of 2-minute lap. I was more than happy with that. And yeah, I think I beat about 5 or 6 guys. So I wasn't last, but it was more just getting around and driving relatively well for my standard and not making any mistakes. That was the key thing. I didn't want to be spinning off and causing a red flag
on the British Grand Prix
in
weekend.
Yeah, exactly. When you've got full stands, most people remember me for going into the hay bales at Goodwood. So they go, oh, here's this Muppet again, you know. So I didn't want to do anything stupid. So it was just about trying to be as clinical and clean and have a good race, which I did for me.
So I think you meant you described that as another sort of bucket list item ticked. You've done them all, you do all these amazing things you're doing for the series. Are there things out there that you haven't done that you want to do, or do you want to get back to Le Mans?
I'd love to go back to Le Mans, because you learn so much and you feel like you've barely scratched the surface. I thought I might have done it and then tick the box and then I can move on, but it really...
Got the bug.
I got the bug. And you learn so much that you want to apply all the things that you learned in that experience. But on top of Le Mans, Bathurst 12-hour, Nürburgring 24... I'd love to do some more rallycross. I mean, that was just a taster for that. It really got me hooked. I guess just any opportunity. And the key thing that I've learned, you know, at the weekend I was racing at Spa in the British GT, in a Mustang GT4, Multimatic, you know, top level pro team, really amazing guys. And at the same time, I was doing the Caterham 420 championship, you know, basically jumping out one car into the next. And you would assume that, well, you know, you've got these, you know, top level teams, and then you've got this sort of 30 grand a year championship, which is just a club level racing. But you know, the experience is just as intense and just as fun in the Caterhams as it is in GTs. So the key thing is, I think it doesn't matter what level you're racing at. You know, talking about the Citroen 2 CVs, I'll bet that's pretty intense when you're in a battle and you're, you know, if you're fighting for the lead and you're
bum drafting down the back straight.
Exactly. It doesn't 40 matter. Miles an hour. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, I honestly think that, you know, as long as you've got team of people around you that care about it and you're all in it together and you're having fun, you know, you can get so much from motorsport at any level. So it's not just about the big ones. Of course, I'd love to do all these iconic races, but just any opportunities. You know, I'm doing the Spa 6-hour in a Lotus Elan later on this year. I'm going to Portimao doing a couple of races out there. I've got Spa this weekend again in a 911 GT2 RS Club Sport, which has got...
Your life is so terrible.
Rubbing it in, sorry, yeah. So yeah, I'm very lucky that I get these opportunities. So when I get them, you want to do them justice. Mm.
So just quickly, tell me a little bit about the Mustang, because it's a bit different. It's quite new.
Yeah.
And you're doing a few races in that.
I just got two races. So I had Donington last month and then Spa last weekend. It's GT4. It is, I guess, the strengths of the Mustang are it's got really good high-speed aero. So through this medium and high-speed corners, it's very stable. You can really commit. It's got really good traction out of the slower corners. Straight-line pace isn't as good as some of the other cars, so we struggled at Spa a little bit because of that. And the brakes, it's not quite as... You can't chuck it in quite as late as some of the other cars. It's quite a heavy car. But we did really well at Donington. We won at Donington. So there's two cars. There was the GT4 Silver and the GT4 Pro-Am. And the GT4 Silver, they won their category and they're leading the championship. And myself and Billy Johnson won the Pro-Am, which was a big surprise. And then last weekend, I raced with Andy Priol. And his son, Seb, was racing in the Silver car with Scott Maxwell. And we were both sixth in our relative classes. So it was a bit tougher. We weren't quite up there with the faster cars in the straight line. But... just so much fun, you know. It really is. It's a great car to drive, great team, and I learned a lot from Andy. But it was nice to be there that weekend, because it's the first time that Andy and Seb had raced side by side ever. So to have your son, I just can't imagine what it'd be like for Callum's five just now, and I couldn't imagine if he'd been old enough and quick enough to race.
It's getting expensive soon.
Yeah, well, I'll keep him on two wheels. It's much cheaper, I think. Yeah.
Now, sort of before we finish, anyone who follows you on Twitter will do one of the... I suppose there's two ways to do social media. As you know, if you're very well known, and that's to basically ignore most people and sort of just keep tweeting. But you're really interactive, and a lot of that is with Hoy Bikes, which is a relatively new. It's a new brand of bicycles.
Yes, we set it up. Well, I started doing when I retired, the question was what next, and I had to have things I was passionate about to really get my teeth into and really get focused on. So I decided to pick a number of things to do rather than just one. You know, thing like with my cycling days. So motorsport was one, but to start my own business, to make my own brand of bike and to start a range. And it started out with a couple of adult bikes, and then we expanded from there, and then we started the kids range. And the adult bikes did okay, but the kids bikes have been so really well received. And we've gone relatively high end, very lightweight components, lightweight frames to make the bikes as easy for the kids to ride as possible. And I guess now becoming a dad as well, you go through this phase of just the wonder of seeing your kids learn to ride their bike, and it's so much fun. It reignites your passion for cycling. So yeah, we do, you know, anyone that's got a Hoy bike out there, if they're posting pictures of their kids out riding, you know, if they send me a message, I'll send them a message back. And it's just great to see, because you see the smiles on their faces when they're out there that first time, when they realize that their mum or dad aren't holding them under the saddle, they're actually pedaling by themselves and that moment of freedom and excitement when you're pedaling on your own.
And you've got your, you know, with your children, you've got your own test riders. Perfect.
Exactly.
I hope you pay them very well.
Well, yeah. Well, they get a free bike out of it. Oh, right. So, can't complain. Yeah, and a new bell, actually. But it's like even like Callum. So Callum was born prematurely. He was, 2 pounds when he was born. He was 11 weeks early. Really tough start. And he's always been, he's been on the catching up since day one. But physically now, he's, as big or bigger than all his mates in nursery. Developmentally as well, he's caught up. But he's always been a little bit, I guess, shy and a bit more reserved, and he doesn't throw himself into things, and certainly new sort of physical activities. He's always a bit kind of on the back foot, but his bite, he just seems to have picked it up. He absolutely loves it. And we went on holiday to Australia at the start of the year, and we went down to the beach, and there was a bike path that went all the way along the beach just for miles and miles. And every sort of kilometre, there's a little play park. And we just went out one day. Sarah was walking the pram with Chloe, and me and Callum set off on the bikes. And we would just stop, have a go on the swings. Callum might as well, not just me. And then we'd go on from place to place. We went on, we did 5K up and 5K back, did 10Ks, and he's only 4. And I'm not some sort of mad parent that's kind of cracking the whip tail. He just absolutely loved it. So it's just, it's wonderful to see kids enjoying themselves. And, it's when you've created it, when you've designed the bikes and you've had a big part of it and you see them having fun in them, it's a cool thing.
Well, what a wonderful note to end on. Chris, thank you so much for all your time. After hearing just how much racing you're doing, it's amazing that you've spared an hour of your time. Thank you so much. It's been truly enlightening. It really, really has. So thank you.
Thank you very
much.
It's been great. Cheers.
And we'll see you all next month for another Motorsport Magazine podcast. Thank you for listening and thank you for watching. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.